This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of All Football Commentators Are Geeks. I'm Michelle Owen from Sky Sports News and Soccer Saturday.
I'm Alex Crook from TalkSport, a national newspaper journalist.
And I'm Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV Sport.
This week, the BBC's Dan Walker puts his geekiness to the test.
And what's the name of the podcast again?
All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Right, okay, yes. Like to join the club.
Good description.
We will be revealing the stats that prove the Everton manager, Marco Silva, has been impressive at the start of his reign at three different Premier League clubs, but then things have floundered quickly. Plus, we'll be looking back on a dramatic and brilliant FA Cup weekend.
Sam will also be telling us how he prepares for a dramatic penalty shootout and his experience of doing a three-way commentary with Alan Brazil and Stuart Pearce.
And I'll be telling you what it's like to be part of Sky's transfer deadline day coverage.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Yes, really looking forward to Thursday. Hello, guys. Where are you? You're together. And why are you together?
Well, he's a stalker, isn't he? He can't keep away from me. And instead of now spending nights in my hotel room, he's just followed me to hotels. No, we're at the Dancing on Ice hotel. So we're at Dancing on Ice last night, and I'm doing Barnet versus Brentford a little bit later on. So I stayed down.
Oh, okay.
He came to watch, and you enjoyed yourself, didn't you?
Do you know what? Having said all along that I wasn't interested, I was only going for the wife, I did really enjoy it, actually. It's a lot better to watch live than it is on television. Even his cheesy lines sound better in the studio than on the TV. And we met some great people. I ended up talking Rotherham with Paul Chuckle. That was a meeting of minds over a bowl of Twiglets. Singing Manchester United songs back at the hotel with Brian McFadden was a moment that I never envisaged. So, yeah, it was a great night.
That revealed all the secrets.
I've heard it all. I'm gutted because I can't make my Dancing on Ice slot that Sam had given to me as I'm working every Sunday in February. So, Crook,
you're just in demand.
You're
just in demand. That's the problem.
Not as in demand as you. So, Crook can tell me all about it when I see him later this week. This weekend, then, was certainly a shot in the arm for anyone who says the FA Cup has lost its sparkle. So, let's take a look at the main stories in numbers.
AFC Wimbledon rekindled memories of their famous 1988 FA Cup final triumph by beating woeful West Ham 4-2. The first time the Dons have scored more than one goal against a higher league side since reforming 17 years ago.
Andre Gray was on target as Watford defeated Newcastle 2-0 in an all-Premier League affair. Gray's last four FA Cup goals have come for four different clubs.
I was at Fratton Park to see QPR come from behind to draw 1-1 with League One. Portsmouth Rangers have not won a fourth round tie since Trevor Sinclair's famous bicycle kick goal against Barnsley way back in 1997.
I saw Everton dumped out of the FA Cup at Millwall. No one has conceded more goals from free kicks and corners in the Premier League this season than the Toffees, and their hosts appear to have been aware of that. All three of the goals came from set plays.
On Thursday, Tottenham were knocked out of the Carabao Cup by Chelsea on penalties. In the decade since Spurs last won a trophy, the Blues have lifted four FA Cups, three Premier Leagues, one double, a League Cup, the Champions League and the Europa League.
I wonder which one of us scripted that bit.
I wonder. Plenty of shocks and surprises then, guys. Who doesn't love the FA Cup? Sam, you had your fair share of excitement. Starting at Stamford Bridge on Thursday, penalty shootouts, they're not that regular. So how many of them have you done in your career and how do you plan for something like that?
Oh, I tend to get quite a lot of them. I don't know why. My missus always jokes that I get, every time it can go to extra time and penalties, it will do with you. And I'm like, yeah, I know, it does. And that was in the Carabao Cup. And what was great about it, I thought, and I think this is something that I think will end up being the norm, is that there was no extra time. It went straight to penalties after the end of the second leg of some 90 minutes. Went straight to penalties. Brilliant. It absolutely, I think, has made the League Cup this season a much more dramatic and exciting competition. How do you prepare for it? I prepared for it by just looking back at previous penalty shootouts. Chelsea had won their previous penalty shootout against Norwich, but lost their previous three, I think. I looked back at all of the players that had taken penalties for Tottenham in their previous shootout against Watford in that competition. But only one of them, because of the injuries that they had, Kane, no Ali, no Son, only one of them was available, and that was Eric Lamella. Of course, you've got the Eric Dier taking a penalty, and he took a penalty that, clinched a shootout for England against Colombia, and we were all waiting for him to turn up and take the fifth penalty, but he took the third penalty and blasted it well over the top of the crossbar. And actually, I think we felt as if in the shootout in the summer, he'd underhit his penalty. So that was sort of on one of my notes. And then he'd overhit it as a result of that in that shootout at Stamford Bridge. And obviously, we know what happened next. But yeah, it was a it was dramatic. And it doesn't matter who you support. I always think that when you're in a situation with a penalty shootout, if you're in the ground, whoever's got the most fans, you want them to win because the noise is so much better. So if you're away from home, it sort of sucks the sort of life out of it if the away team wins in a way, because you don't get that noise. But when you're in, you know, you're at Stamford Bridge and Chelsea have won it, obviously you get that very loud noise, the party that goes on afterwards, and it sort of caps off the event, really, I think. So I think it was an interesting night, that's for sure.
So that was Thursday. On Friday, you had the company of not only Stuart Pearce, but Alan Brazil at the Emirates. I bet you enjoyed the free bar.
There is a free bar afterwards at Arsenal as well. Yes, it was interesting, actually, doing a three-way commentary. It's something that we've started to do over the last couple of weeks. I've done it with Ryan Mason and Stuart Pearce the previous Saturday. That was Arsenal-Chelsea. Then I did Ali McCoist and Stuart Pearce on the Thursday night. Friday night was Stuart and Alan. And yeah, Alan was brilliant, actually. He came up to me beforehand and he said, "Look, Sam, what I'm going to do is I'm going to wait for you to bring me in."
So what is that voice?
I don't know. It's supposed to be my Alan Brazil accent, but I haven't had enough years of the red wine to gravel it up enough.
You had enough last night.
And he said, "I'm going to wait for Stuart to talk and then I'm going to let you bring me in before I start talking." And I was like, "Oh, that's a good idea, because it means that we've sort of thought about how we're going to do it." Anyway, after 30 seconds, he was steaming straight in. didn't wait once. Hardly allowed anyone to pause for breath before he gave his point in. I must say, I thought he was brilliant. I thought his reading of the game was excellent. And I think he loved it. And his voice, especially after the goals, was superb. And it was reminiscent of those old days when he was doing Sky stuff.
Do you remember we did a four-way commentary once? Myself, you, Steve Stone and David Unsworth. It was Portsmouth against Southampton in the FA Cup. And what was memorable about that game was that Portsmouth had just signed a very poor Greek goalkeeper called Kostas Halkias. It was his debut. And bearing in mind, Steve Stone was still on the staff at the time. He absolutely hammered him. Yeah, but Steve Stone in particular killed him on the air. Just said how bad he was. "Beware Greeks bearing gifts," I think was the line he used. I said to him, "Stoney, you do know he's your teammate."
He was nicknamed Kostas lots of goals, wasn't he?
He was terrible.
Michelle, what have you been up to this week?
I was at Bristol City against Bolton on Friday, which Bristol City won 2-1 to progress to the next round. They're doing brilliantly at the moment. That's 12 unbeaten for them in a row. And Saturday, because Soccer Saturday doesn't have rights to FA Cup games, I went to see some League One action between Wickham and Plymouth Argyle. Said something on Twitter after that might have caused a bit of reaction.
I saw this.
Well, basically, I've done this game a number of times between these two. There's a lot of needle between the two clubs because the two managers, Derek Adams and Gareth Ainsworth, they don't get on. They've refused to shake hands before. Wickham do like to use some game management tactics in this game. From what I've seen, that is what happens every time.
You say game management now, but on Twitter, didn't you call it time wasting?
I put the exact tweet before things escalate again. Was that Wickham are experts at game management, also known as time wasting, against Plymouth Argyle. Every time I've covered this game, it's the same. Wickham fans didn't really like that. Some were like, "Yeah, we know what we are." And I said, "Look, it's only in this particular game. I've covered them in other games and it hasn't been quite as rife." But, you know, they had the physios who were at the touchline on one side of the pitch walk all the way across the other side of the pitch, and the ref just waiting for the keeper to take the kit, dead ball situations. Wickham took their time over everything. The final 25 minutes, they couldn't really have gone much slower. That's the truth. That's what I saw. That's what I'm reporting. When you report, you have to form an opinion.
Yeah.
How dare you have an opinion, was the reaction of a lot of people. And then there was one delightful young man who transpires, has links directly to the club, I found out, who called me a lovely word, which I won't see on this podcast, but if you wish to see it, go and look at my Twitter.
Didn't Adrian Durham, our Talk Sport colleague, leap to your defence over that particular tweet? Call for him to be banned, didn't he?
I know. I messaged Adrian after saying thanks for the backup, but... An apology would suffice, but this guy doesn't want to apologise, and it's quite surprising given how linked he is to the club as well.
So, just for people who are listening, he did actually abuse you, didn't he? I mean, he called you a word, which begins with S, ends in G, and you can put the rest of it in the middle quite easily. But with no other context in the tweet at all, there was no sort of like, it wasn't sort of like making a point and that was like his final little barb. The whole point of the tweet was just to send that word to you because you had a view on football. So this guy who works closely with that football club thought it was appropriate.
He knows someone that works closely.
Either way, it doesn't matter who he is, thinks that it is appropriate to react to someone criticising a football team by abusing them like that. Now, this is the problem. And this is one of the issues that I had on Friday night and Saturday as well, because there was stuff going on at Millwall, which I wasn't aware of till afterwards, and stuff that went on Friday night, which is just absolutely ludicrous. I mean, the Arsenal fans fighting amongst themselves and getting annoyed with each other and pretending to have little scraps and throwing coins at players. Why? Because your football team lost a football match. Just think about what you're doing. Think about your job. Think about your kids. Is that an appropriate reaction to what has just happened?
Very eloquently put, Sam. That's the thing as well. I've got to say, the vast majority of people were like, he doesn't speak for us as Wickham fans. But then there's still some backing him up and saying, you're lucky you weren't called worse and things like that. And you're just thinking, what are you on about? Like, what does your weekend consist of to go onto Twitter and to do that? And if it was against, I don't know, their mum or their sister or female friend, they'd hate it. And my husband took one look at it. He's like, I'm just going to have to put the phone down. If not, I'll say something I regret. But that is called maturity. And unfortunately, a lot of these people don't have it. You're listening to the All Football Commentators to Geeks podcast. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. The handles are exactly the same, at AFC Geeks. Crook will be speaking to Football Focus and BBC Breakfast host Dan Walker next and finding out why he refuses to work on Sundays.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks. Saturday was a special day for Portsmouth as Football Focus came live from Fratton Park before their FA Cup fourth round tie with QPR. And afterwards, Crook caught up with presenter Dan Walker.
I'm with Dan Walker, who's just come off the air from a live broadcast for Football Focus. How much do you enjoy doing live TV and the manic nature of it?
I love it. I love the idea that something and everything and often the whole show can go wrong. I mean, today, so we're at Fratton Park today, we're doing Portsmouth against QPR and fourth round the FA Cup. And it's been a bit frantic all morning, not really been able to rehearse anything. We're in the Victory Lounge there, no idea how many fans are going to turn up. In actual fact, we've had hundreds come, and that's what I love about it, because they care, they're passionate about the club. You know, they're really worried about what Portsmouth have been through over the last few years, and that just sort of shines through. And when you're interviewing a 88-year-old called David in there today, I don't know any other Portsmouth fans who were at both FA Cup finals that they won, 1939 and 2008, and he's got pictures, he's got tickets, his dad was here at a game in 1912. That's what it's all about, isn't it? And I love it when it comes through from clubs like Portsmouth, and the on-the-road programmes are my favourites that we do.
You mentioned the jeopardy of a live broadcast like that. Has there ever been one example that stands out of where something has gone really badly wrong?
Yes. I still sort of regret saying, actually. It was a young man at a second round of the FA Cup. So before we got to the big teams coming in round three. And he had made a tinfoil cup. And he was very proud of this tinfoil cup. And you know sometimes when you're live, you don't get a chance to think everything through clearly. And sometimes you say stuff you regret. And I took the mickey out of his tinfoil cup live on air. And Dean Saunders was one of the pundits that day, and he absolutely, and rightly so, he rinsed me for it. And then it was so bad, and I got so much grief for it, I had to get the lad back on at the end of the programme. And he had the opportunity to insult me back, and he gave me 4 out of 10 for my presenting skills, so, which I think was fair. It's one of those, isn't it? When you like, I love that element that it feels, you know, you're thinking on the seat of your pants, and you're so much can happen, and people can throw things in that test your knowledge, and that's where your research comes into it, and you're trying to make sure that everything is as accurate and as clear as it can be. And you know, that a lot of that comes down to how you've researched, how long you've been doing it, and sort of your knowledge of sort of the TV aspect of it, and introducing your football knowledge to that at the same time. And that's why, thankfully, I mean, the next one might be a disaster. We don't get many problems, and hopefully they're a good watch for people at home as well.
Obviously, most people now recognise you from Football Focus and also BBC Breakfast, but you started out actually at Radio Hallam in Sheffield. I think you worked with Jules Warren from Sky Sports News.
The great Jules Warren, yeah. And then I went to Piccadilly in Manchester, and Jules actually came as like a trainee there. So I like to say I trained Jules, you know, showed him the way. But he's one of those. It's brilliant to see. When you first meet somebody like that and you think, wow, he's switched on, he's quick thinking, he understands sort of the medium of radio or telly, whatever it might be. And he was one of those. You see lots of people who come in on sort of work experience or start off, and you think, OK, they've got a lot of work to put in to get to where they want to be. And Jules was one of those from day one. I thought, essentially, if he's willing to work hard, he can go as far as he wants to go. And now when you watch him on Soccer Saturday, or, you know, doing the midweek games, essentially he's Jeff's number two, isn't he? And he's just brilliant. It's effortless, and it was a pleasure to sort of see that really early on when he was doing news and he was doing sport on radio, and now he's just transferred that into telly, and I think he's brilliant, and still a genuinely lovely bloke. He's very annoyingly good at music as well. He's good at everything, Jules.
He's one of those.
Yeah.
Was it always your aim, starting out, to one day go into live television and work your way up the BBC ladder?
I suppose sort of. I wrote a letter to Des Lynam when I was 11, sort of saying, "Dear Des, I love your moustache. How do I get your job?" And he wrote back and he said, do GCSEs, do your A-levels, do a degree, but don't do media studies, he said back then. Do something like English or history, something that teaches you to write well and assess sources and things like that, and then do a postgraduate course in broadcast journalism and then get a job in local radio, which, bizarrely, is exactly the path that I took. But, you know, the little 11-year-old who knew he wasn't good enough to play football professionally but wanted to be involved in it, I never thought that would happen. So I was, you know, for much of my life, I was determined to be a teacher. I had a great history teacher at school. I loved Mr. Lowles. So I always thought that that's the road that I was going to go down. And until I got turned down to be on a PGCE for being too immature. I know. And then, sort of that next week, I thought, well, you know, I've always wanted to have a crack at broadcasting. Let's give it a go. I applied for a commentary competition. I won that. I got a first sort of 2 weeks at Hallam FM in Sheffield, and sort of doors opened after that. So I by this point in my life, I should really be teaching in a secondary school somewhere, bit of history and some PE. That was my dream for a long time.
Clearly, you didn't go down the route of growing the Des Lynam moustache. But
no,
have you?
I look terrible with facial hair on it.
Have you modelled your style on anybody in particular, Des or Gary Lineker, or is it important to be your own man?
I think it's really important to be your own man or your own woman in this industry. I mean, I often say now to students or people who say, how do I get to do some of the jobs you're doing? How can I follow in your footsteps? And I always think, find a style. Find something that is naturally you. Because you can't, if you start imitating people, eventually you'll get found out, and it'll become clear that you're not genuine. And I think viewers and listeners can hear that and see that. Oh, it's rainy-ish.
Should we move into the shelter? The perils of live broadcasting,
exactly.
See?
I think, Alex, that people can see that quite quickly. So you've got to be yourself, and being yourself means that I think there's a real genuine nature to what you do. So I go out there and I think, I love Des Lynam, and there's loads of people I look up to. You know, Claire Balding's brilliant, Gabby Logan's brilliant. I usually love watching Jim Rosenthal, because Jim could always talk, slamming door there, Jim could always talk to time perfectly. And people like Steve Ryder, and all those people I grew up watching, Bob Wilson, who were brilliant at their job, and you think, OK, well, I'll learn a bit from that, and I can see how that works. But then when you go out and do that yourself, I've got to be myself in that situation. And I often think as well that
you put a bit of pressure on yourself as well to make sure that you can be as good as you can be. And I quite like that pressure. I quite like that adrenaline, that little rush you get from knowing that if you mess up, it's your fault. And I think that's what I really enjoy about the art of live broadcasting. And I love being involved in telly and radio, but there is still something brilliant about a red light going on a camera and you knowing that you're talking to millions of people and anything could go wrong. And I love that.
One of my first gigs in media, Sam actually employed me to read the sports news on local radio here in Portsmouth, ironically. He hired me for 2 weeks and he made me get up at 5 o'clock to be on air at 7. I quit after a week because I couldn't handle the early starts. How do you balance that? Well, what time do you get up for your breakfast gig?
I've got no idea how I sort of work on such a limited amount of sleep. I remember reading years ago that Margaret Thatcher survived on 4 hours sleep. So I get about 4 hours, 20 minutes a night. Wow. I go to bed far too late and I get up. My alarm goes off at 11 minutes past three. To come to Portsmouth today. So I was working last night. So I was working in Sheffield until 10:45. Then drove down to Portsmouth, got here at 10 past three, and then I was here this morning at the club at 8:30. But I'm not sure this is particularly healthy. When I first started breakfast, Bill Turnbull, who I took over from, he said, "Dan, I don't feel I need to give you any advice. I'm sure you'd be great," which is lovely. And he said, "But the only thing I would say to you is manage your sleep. If you get that wrong, you'll have trouble down the line." I've been doing it nearly 3 years now, and foolishly, I've entirely ignored Bill's advice. Lots of those who I work with, Louise Minchin has a nap during the day. I always find if I sleep during the day, I can't sleep at night. So, for the first half of the week, I sort of operate on just over 4 hours kip, and which is why I look like this.
You look better than me on 8 hours sleep. One day of the week you don't work, of course, is a Sunday. Just explain to our listeners the reasons behind that.
Yeah, my faith has always been really important to me. And right from the start, I knew the sort of person I am and my enthusiasm for the job. I knew that if I didn't give myself a break somewhere, then I certainly wouldn't be married for the length of time I've been married, have 3 children and have a sort of balance in life. And for me, and don't make anybody else do this, my sister's a nurse, she works on most Sundays. But I always think I have that Sunday special where it's a good reminder for me as well, there are more important things in life than football, than whatever else I'm working on. And I work my backside off for the other 6 days of the week, but that is a day that I spend with my family, at church, doing something a little bit different. And I think that really gives me a good perspective and a balance in my life, which, again, because if I allowed my sort of personality to take over, I would never stop working. And people get cross with me. Some people telling me I'm an idiot, and lots of people probably listening to this thinking, how on earth have you got to where you are not doing that? But, some doors have slammed in my face, others have opened, and that's just something which I take seriously. And I don't think it's held me back. From my own perspective, it's made me a better broadcaster. So,
So what happens? The World Cup final's on a Sunday, and you're asked to anchor the coverage on BBC television.
That will never happen because Gary's in charge.
But if it did?
I don't think that question will ever be asked. But my bosses know where I stand, and those sort of offers have come in over the years, and I've stood firm because I just think there's more important things. And the positives of not working on a Sunday for me far outweigh the some people would consider to be the negatives. I love Sundays, my favourite day of the week. So, and I've got 3 children who I need to spend as much time with as possible, and that's really important. I don't want to get to the age of 50 and think I wish I'd spent more time with my kids. So,
we've just got an announcement going on the PA. So, of course, this is what happens. This is it.
And turnstiles are unlocked, ready for opening.
There you go. They're on their way
They're
in.
They're just opening the gates. We better wrap it up reasonably soon. You've covered a lot of different sports. From rugby to Formula One, football, golf. Is football your first love? And was there any one of those particular sports that you didn't feel comfortable to cover and maybe you had to improve your knowledge?
I absolutely adore golf. I've got a deep love of golf. When I got to the age of 40, I set myself a ridiculous target of becoming a scratch golfer just because I thought I'm going to try and do this. So I've always played off sort of single figures, but I got from 7 down to 2 But it's really, I've got enough time, so I might have to give up on that plan. So I love covering golf, but football is my first love. I mean, my dad took me to a first game when I was a tiny little nipper. He was a big Tottenham fan. I used to go and watch Crawley Town play every single week, fell in love with it then. And there is still, I don't understand people who can't get their head around football. I mean, even if you don't become obsessive about it, and I can leave it. My mood is not dictated by what happens on a weekend. But just that, when the teams come out at 3 o'clock whenever they play, that buzz and that noise and that roar and that sort of feeling that you get, the sort of the bass of the fans sort of rumbling through your body is beautiful. And I think if you actually come into a live game, so much is on telly these days, if you sit or stand at a live game, there is still something captivating about that. And for me, I know I'm waffling on, but if I go back to the World Cup in 2010, when Ghana lost to Uruguay, I think that is about as intense an atmosphere as I've ever been in.
Suarez handball.
Exactly. Suarez handball went off, was sent off, came back down the tunnel when Asamoah Gyan then missed the penalty, which would have put Ghana through. And then they won the subsequent penalty shootout. The fact that the whole of the nation, the whole continent of Africa was on Ghana's side there, last African side left in the competition, desperate for them to progress, and then to be robbed in that way, but that is what sport and football at the top level is all about, that raw emotion. I was sat next to a man who's a Ghana fan. I remember turning to him when they lost the penalty shootout, and just the weight of emotion in his face and the scream that he let out. I just when you ask me about sort of emotion in sport, that is the thing that really sticks out for me. But the one, to go back to your question, I think the one sport that I had to sort of get as much knowledge as possible about was horse racing, because I love it, but I've never been an aficionado. So I covered the Grand National and the Derby and various other races for quite a few years for BBC. And this is one bit of advice I always say to people is, when you're at an event and you don't know everything about it, hoover up everything you can, but be aware of little important bits that you can throw in. And the editor of the programme, a guy called Dermot Comiskey, was brilliant. He said, Dan, I want you to go out to Canal Turn and do a live during the Grand National Race for us. I went, yeah, no problem. So I'm thinking, OK, I'll go out there, do a bit of prep. And I went out there, and they were having, I could hear a couple of the jockeys who were working on the Grand National. They were talking about a race in 2001. And they said, do you remember that thing when Paddy's Return was a horse that sort of cut across Canal Turn and he took everyone else out in the race, and Red Marauder won at 33-1 and Smarty was second, and they were some of the only two finishers. I just thought, well, that's an interesting statistic. I'll just lock that one away. And then on the Saturday, the Grand National, I went to go and sit on a canal, which runs just by Aintree, and I spoke to this guy in a canal boat, and I just wandered up to him, unprepared, and I said, how long have you been here? He goes, actually, we came for the first time in 2001. And I thought, well, that's fortunate. He says, do you remember the name of the horse? And he goes, yes, it was Paddy's Return. I said, and who won that year? And he went, I can't remember, Red Marauder at 33-1. And after the programme, I went back into the truck, and the editor said, how on earth did you know that? I said, I didn't give the game away. But that's what it's all about. Sometimes it's about just key, salient facts, knowing a little bit, but not too much, so that somebody listening who knows it, horse racing inside out, thinks, what on earth are you talking about? Mm. But enough to make sure that you understand the sport and can convey that to the people who are watching. So one of those fortunate ones that went my way over the years, that one.
Amazing how Dan survived on literally no sleep. And that story about writing to Des Lynam when he was a young boy is really cute. I did a similar thing with Mark Pugach, actually. But I don't have the letter, which is annoying. Coming up, in the final part of the programme, we will be talking transfer deadline day.
Welcome back to the last section of All Football Commentators at Geeks. It's that time of year again when Jim White digs out his famous yellow tie. He's doing two shifts this year. He's doing TalkSport in the morning and Sky Sports News in the evening. Harry Redknapp interviewed for a car window, although I don't think that he'll be getting involved this time around. Thursday is, of course, transfer deadline day. I'll be hosting a show on TalkSport from 7 till 10 that night. Before we get into that in detail, I don't think that Everton will be too busy on transfer deadline day. I don't know if you saw this story this week, that £750,000 a week is being spent by Everton on players' wages who aren't anywhere near the first team. So they are wasting £750,000 on players like Henry Onkoronkou, who's away on loan. Sandro Ramirez gets £120,000 a week, but he's on loan at Real Sociedad. And there's a great article actually doing the rounds on the internet about breaking down these huge wages that were offered in that Ronald Koeman splurge after they'd sold Romelu Lukaku. But interestingly, you know, I do feel a bit sorry for Marco Silva because he is in a situation where he's working with three different sets of players. Koeman's players, he's working with Allardyce's players and his own players. It's a difficult situation for any manager to be in. But I saw these brilliant stats about how things obviously change when he comes into a club. He has a good impact on them. For example, when he first went to Hull, they took 17 points from 11 games, his first 11 games in charge. At Watford, he took 21 points from his first 13 games in charge. And at Everton, they took 18 points from his first 11 games in charge. But it's interesting to see what happens next. I know you've sort of had a view on what happens next, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been quite outspoken about Marco Silva, not just after the game at the weekend, but throughout his managerial career, really, because I don't get it why he's seen as this managerial messiah. I don't know what he's ever done. Everyone says what a fantastic job he did at Hull City. Last time I checked, they still were relegated to the Championship. Then everybody lauds the start that he made at Watford. Yes, brilliant for 2 months of the season, as his team seemed to be wherever he goes, but absolutely fell off a cliff after that, and he was sacked. And at Everton, you say he's working with three sets of players. He spent a lot of money in the summer, not least on Richarlison, who for me is a luxury player who still doesn't perform on a consistent enough basis. I just don't get it. I don't get why he doesn't get more scrutiny. I don't particularly warm to him as a person. Whenever I interview him, he's surly, he doesn't smile.
I've never seen him smile.
No. So, yeah, for me, I think he's the most overrated manager in the Premier League.
That's a bit of a strong statement, but do think that he has to stay somewhere for a little bit longer than he has done previously. Because if you look at all of his jobs, even before he came to this country, even at Olympiacos, I don't think he's ever done a full season, or if he has, he's done one full season at a football club. And you mentioned about how his teams are good for 2 months and then not after that. Well, I mentioned those starts. Hull, 17 points from his first 11 games. I spoke to some of the players there and they were absolutely convinced that this guy was amazing when he first joined. But then they took 4 points from the next 7 games after that. And if you look at Everton after their great start, 18 points from these first 11 games, they've taken 9 from the next 10. And now they've gone out of the FA Cup to Millwall. Watford, 21 points from 13, as I mentioned. And then they took 5 points from the next 11 games. And after Richarlison's great start, he didn't score for 27 games at the end of last season. So I think there's certainly, and you said there should be more scrutiny on him, there will be more scrutiny on him. I think Everton as a football club need to keep a manager for longer than a year and a half. I think he needs to stay at a club for longer than 18 months just to sort of show that they both can work in a more stable environment. I think it would benefit them both if they do that. But certainly results and the form of his team have got to improve. Also, the idea that everyone knows that they concede loads of goals from set plays and then Millwall score 3 from set plays is obviously, like, you know, a pretty basic tactic, especially when Andre Gomez is marking Jake Cooper at set pieces. It's mad. Anyway, Michelle, let's move on to deadline day, because I don't think Everton will have the money to be able to spend on deadline day, but others will. Where will you be?
To be confirmed. Obviously, it depends on what happens in the next few days. So you'll just have to wait and see where I pop up. Ooh, on Thursday.
I know.
In summer, I was at Cardiff. Last January, I was at Leicester City, which was a fascinating day. We were pretty much top story all day because, if you cast your mind back, of Riyad Mahrez. Was he leaving? Was he not? Wasn't training. Then had to go back in and sort of apologise. And it was a crazy situation, but really absorbing because it kept you busy all day. And you sort of start at like 6 or 7 in the morning. And our last hit was at midnight. So it's an incredibly long day. But it's one of those days where anything can happen. And that is what's so exciting about it. You know, don't ask me why. Maybe you guys can shed some light on this. But clubs always, always leave it to the last minute to sign players. And in most circumstances, it doesn't make any sense why you'd wait to the last minute. If you know a player is available and unforeseen circumstances haven't happened at your club all month, then why do you wait until the 31st of January? I'm glad they do. It makes it very entertaining. But it's the same every year, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this window historically is of more interest to the clubs at the wrong end of the Premier League table. You tend to find the teams fighting to stay up are the ones who panic by on deadline day. I'm actually going to be covering the South Coast for TalkSport during their live coverage throughout the day. I'm not anticipating a lot of action. I think Bournemouth have got their business done. They've splurged early this window. I think Chris Meppen will probably be their last arrival. Chris Hughton, who seems an honest sort, has already said that he doesn't expect Brighton to do anything on deadline day. All eyes on Southampton. But again, I think the emphasis there will be more on getting players off the wage bill than bringing them in. They're desperate to offload Fraser Forster. I mean, you mentioned wages. He's the highest paid player that Southampton have ever had, and he can't even get on the bench. Whether anybody in the Championship is going to take on those wages, well, they're not going to take on those wages, but whether they're going to take him on and Southampton pay a percentage, we shall see. Charlie Austin is another player they've made it clear can leave if a club comes in. So it's fascinating. I think it's become almost like Christmas Day for fans. You know, I know people who take days off work to sit on the sofa and watch Jim White and co from the first light until the window closes at 11 o'clock. Personally, I can't quite get my head around that. But I also think it puts pressure on clubs because fans want to be excited on deadline day. They want their team to be buying players. And if they don't, they get pilloried for it.
I always think if you're leaving your business to the final day of the window, you're not doing very well as a football club because you should have planned your recruitment a little bit better. I think the excuses come if you are someone like Tottenham and you plan not to recruit anybody, but now you probably feel as if you need to because the injuries that you've got. So I still don't think they'll do any business, but I could understand if they did. Arsenal, similarly, they've had so many problems in their defensive line. I think they might try and sign someone on loan. But, of course, that is another big story, the fact that they're looking for people on loan. I think they're trying to sign Malcolm, the Brazilian winger from Barcelona. But that would be a deal that was on loan until the end of the season and then a permanent transfer later because for whatever reason, probably Mesut Ozil's wage packet, they can't afford to pay at the moment out for transfer fees. I think there'll be a lot of outs at Everton. Because obviously they're trying to shift people out of off the wage bill. I think the same at Chelsea. You may well see one or two end up moving on from there. I'm hoping that Callum Hudson-Odoi does not move on in this transfer window and that Chelsea can try and convince him to stay. I think his long-term future is probably elsewhere, sadly. But I think we saw over the weekend just how much of a talent he is. It'd be interesting to see whether or not the likes of Leicester, Newcastle, even Everton bother to do any business because ultimately their seasons are over, aren't they? I mean, unless you're Newcastle United, maybe you're trying to stay in the Premier League. I mean, a lot of those clubs in the middle, you've got 12 teams that are out of the FA Cup now, right? There's a lot of teams that already, at the end of January, their season is finished. So there'll be a lot of directors of football and chairmen that say, well, I'm not spending any money now, we'll wait till the summer.
Michelle, I have a question for you. Are you encouraged by your bosses at Sky to try and generate interest when you're stood outside a club, even if you know nothing is happening? The reason I ask this is because there was one reporter outside a ground this time last year who was saying, oh, I'm hearing there could be a couple of arrivals in and out. Now, I was being told from within the corridors of power at the club, their business was done, and that proved to be correct. So I just wonder, it's difficult for you, isn't it, when they've sent you to a ground to stand outside on camera when fans are eagerly awaiting news and actually nothing's happening. So are you encouraged to be creative, shall we say?
Personally, I've never done that. Because if you say that and it's not true, you get all the fans' hopes up, which I think is a little bit unfair. If you genuinely think there's a rumour, then, you know, transfer deadline day is the day you can go with it, isn't it? Out of all the days of the year, a deadline day is perhaps when you get that poetic license, as you say, to be creative. But personally, I've never stood outside a ground and made stuff up. And it's so, so easy to get things wrong on deadline day as well. You have to trust your source. You have to be certain of what they're saying. What happened for me in August, oh, this is horrible. I hate even speaking about it, but I will. I was stood outside Cardiff City Stadium. I was told that Harry Arter, by a source down in Bournemouth, was still at the training ground. So I was like, are you sure? Have you just seen him? And he was absolutely certain about this. He was adamant. So, you know, sort of 1 o'clock, I say, Harry Arter hasn't left Bournemouth yet. You know, it's a 5 p.m. deadline, so it looks unlikely that he'll be coming. But we'll keep you updated on it. Then I get a call from a source very high up to do with Cardiff City, who tells me that Harry Art is on the motorway crossing the Severn Bridge. So it's one of those that you have to trust your sources. And obviously I jumped back on and said that. But that source in Bournemouth I no longer trust. So
but that's okay though, right? Okay, because yeah, that is deadline day, right?
Exactly, so that's
on
my
deadline,
point. Deadline day,
stuff changes and it flips and flops. I don't think, and I think you're being a little bit mischievous there, Crook, in terms of, is the drama played up on television in terms of making, not, but inventing sort of the idea of something happening. I think ultimately there's always something happening because people are always trying to get things done. There's so many deals. And this is what makes me laugh when people say, oh, you got that wrong and you got this wrong because something didn't go through. There are deals that almost go over the line. There are deals that literally have the paperwork done, the medicals done, but still for whatever reason miss the deadline and don't go through, that we never hear about publicly. Because clubs don't ever speak about those deals that didn't quite come off. And because of that, there's a lot of stuff that people don't know about. Some deals will go through in August this year or in June next year, or whenever the first of the window opens. I think it's the 1st of July, actually. A lot of deals will go through that were supposed to go through in the next 3 days that didn't manage to get over the line because of some sort of negotiation. The deal will already be done and then they'll just have to wait and rubber stamp it. So there's always sort of machinations going on. The best clubs do their recruitment well, well, well in advance. The ones that have an emergency on the last few days, they can do business around now. If you are panicking, bringing 4 or 5 in at this stage of the year, then I think you're in serious trouble anyway. And I think, you know, looking at some of the clubs that will be trying to do business at this time of the year, that sort of underlines that.
Well, sadly, our transfer window has slammed shut for another week. Do join us next time when BBC commentator and ITV presenter Jackie Oatley will be taking our questions.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.